It's the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Think about what it's like to ride that super fast, double-looped, mountain-high roller coaster. Hyper-focused, you study the rickety bones of the structure while waiting your turn. You hear the clattering of the cars as they climb to the highest peak and then watch as they plunge toward the ground with their loads of screaming passengers. Eventually, the cars glide back to the starting position, and it's your turn. You climb in. There's no turning back. You reach the summit yourself, stare down in disbelief, and begin plummeting earthward. Your heart rate jumps. Your stomach is in your mouth. Your brain is flashing warning signals. Adrenaline is pumping through your system. What you're experiencing is the fight-or-flight response, or simply fear. Why do we wait patiently so we can scare ourselves silly? Margie Kerr, a thrill-seeker herself, is about to explain. She's a sociologist who studies fear and is a nationally recognized expert on professional haunted houses. In fact, she moonlights at one of the scariest. She received her PhD in sociology from the University of Pittsburgh, where she currently teaches. Her work has been featured in the Washington Post, Parade, and NPR's Science Friday, among others. She's the author of this new book called Scream: Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Margie Kerr lives in Pittsburgh and joins us today by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's so nice to be on.
So let's get right to it. You've been to countless haunted houses, ridden on the most terrifying rides. You've visited an abandoned prison at midnight, experienced excruciatingly high heights, and put yourself in the murder and kidnapping capital of the world. Why do this?
Well, for some reason, I love it. It's really what motivated me to write the book, is to try and understand why I like doing these crazy things. I grew up doing lots of different types of risky kind of reckless activities, riding horses and playing roller derby and just basically running around like a, you know, mad woman. And I really wanted to try and understand what was behind all of that. And I understood that I must be getting something from it. So the past 8 years really has been my attempt to figure this out, to see what we are gaining from voluntarily engaging with these scary, thrilling activities. And I found that there are lots of reasons, so many reasons why we do it.
Well, let's talk about some of those reasons.
Sure. So first, the fight-or-flight response, the threat response, does carry its own natural sort of motivators to continue to thrill-seek. And so that's the release of things like endorphins and dopamine and oxytocin, serotonin. All of these things are released when we are in a high-stress situation. And typically, you know, when we're in a high-stress situation, we're probably not very happy about it because our life is in danger or we're feeling threatened. But when we're in a safe environment, when we know that nothing is really going to hurt us, we can sort of enjoy that response. We can enjoy the physical response that comes from being afraid. It's a blend of sort of our thinking brain reminding our body, saying, oh, you know what, this was scary, this was a startle scare, or, you know, you're on a roller coaster. But then, you know, as our thinking brain comes online, it reminds us that we're not actually in danger. So we can just sort of relax and enjoy it.
You say that amusement parks are a big business here and have only grown in popularity. And in many ways, we are safer and we're obsessed with safety here.
Yeah.
So why do we want to scare ourselves?
I think that it is, you know, that the two things are related, that, you know, today for many people, not everyone, but our lives are objectively very safe and very routine. We don't really have a lot of highs and lows. You know, it's very much daily routine, go to work, come home. And that's a limited emotional experience if we're always sort of just at neutral. So when it comes to sort of taking ourselves into a different emotional kind of experience, I think that that's rewarding. So some people find it through, you know, going to haunted houses or watching scary movies. For other people, they might like to turn on a sad song and just cry their eyes out for no reason other than it just inherently feels good to have a different emotional experience. So I think that that's part of it, that we do want to to sort of, you know, test our emotional range and feel. And since our lives are perhaps more protected and more sort of narrow, we need these experiences to, or these simulated experiences to kind of stretch our wings and feel it. But there is differences between people, both, you know, psychologically and at the biological level, that do influence whether they will enjoy something or not. There's been research looking at the differences in the threat response between people. So some people may have an especially efficient dopamine response, which may mean they get a little extra, you know, enjoyment out of thrill seeking, while others may not. And so that could influence whether they like it or not.
Is there any way to predict who will enjoy something like a thrill ride? Well, it's really
the current protocol that I'm working on with a colleague here in Pittsburgh. We're trying to determine just that, if you can predict, you know, who will benefit from high arousal sort of thrilling experiences. And we do see some, we do a study that looks at brain patterns, and we also administer a bunch of surveys. And we can see some patterns, you know, people who are looking to challenge themselves, people who are thrill seekers, so basically asking questions in advance to determine the personality or some characteristics, you can say, okay, this person probably will enjoy this experience versus, you know, this person may not. So there are some indicators that we're seeing, you know, that can kind of predict whether they will enjoy it.
I mentioned in the introduction that you moonlight at one of America's scariest haunted houses, known as Scare House in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Can you tell us about it and what you do there?
Sure. So Scare House has been around since 1999, and I've been working with them since 2008. I came in really as a data analyst to look at their customer response surveys to basically analyze a bunch of data and tell them what their customers were saying. And that really opened a whole new world to me. Reading about what people find scary is fascinating, because they have no, you know, they're not holding back in these surveys. They're just saying everything that they would fear. So I started seeing patterns in what people found scary and sharing that information with the designers and the creators at Scare House. And it became a really nice collaborative relationship where I would say, oh, you know, it looks like a lot of people are very into zombies or very into, you know, ghosts this year. And then the designers would go forward and use that in the design of the actual scares. I'd also bring in sort of just information from psychology and from the different sciences that talk about what we respond to, you know, universally. So just different types of startle scares, different types of stimuli that we know will trigger a fight or flight response. And then they take that and turn it into amazing sets and scenes and create really fun experiences.
So you're partly responsible for why it's the scariest haunted house in the country.
Without the designers, it would just be probably a bunch of air horns and lights, at least upstairs. But there is an attraction that Scare House has called The Basement, which I'm more involved with from the sort of design and implementation aspect. So down in the basement, I get to do a little bit more creative design around, you know, just building these experiences that are meant to scare you but also make you feel good.
So you mentioned zombies. Are there actually trends of scary figures?
Yeah, there are. And it's really, from a data standpoint, I think it's so much fun to look at, because from 2008 to 2015, I can chart the slow, you know, rise of interest in zombies to the peak around 2011, and then it slowly started declining again. And it seems like zombies, you know, they're still popular, they're still, you know, hot, but I think that they're on the way down. Same thing with things like ghosts or, you know, creepy kids. 1 year, everybody was talking about how scary creepy children were. It's fascinating to see these trends, because they are really good reflections of what's happening in society at the time and, you know, what is on the mind of the masses.
Can you tell what's on the horizon?
There's been sort of a return to a lot of nostalgic stuff, which I believe is probably influenced by shows like American Horror Story and especially Freak Show. I think a lot of people are sort of still, at least this is from last year's data, we're in that mindset of the early 1900s sort of ventriloquists and creepy dolls and sort of sideshow aspect. It seemed like that was really growing. And then this year, I'm interested to see what will be really trending this year. We don't usually do the surveys until after the season, but I have a feeling, well, I always am wondering when aliens are going to come back, because nobody seems to be afraid of aliens, at least in Pittsburgh. It's aliens never seem to make the charts.
This is Margie Kirsch. She's a sociologist who studies fear, and she's written this book called Scream. It explains the science of fear and how it affects our minds and bodies. Is it good for us to scare ourselves?
It can be. I think it's very much a individual level decision that people should make for themselves. The most critical aspect of growing from being scared is control and choice. Those two things have to be in place to grow from a thrilling or scary experience. And I believe really do form the line between true kind of trauma and fun fear. You know, when control is taken away, when your choice is taken away, then you really are at risk. But there have been a few studies that have looked at the importance of control in experiences, and they do show that when you are confronting something challenging, if you know that you can engage at any time and disengage at any time, you choose to stay. You choose to continue to engage because you know in the back of your head, well, I can push myself because I know I'm safe. Whereas if you're in an uncontrollable or an inescapable environment, panic, anxiety, and stress take the center focus in your mind. So you really can't sort of think about what you're experiencing and really sort of challenge yourself. You make fear kind of safe, and you actually can grow from it. These experiences, they are sort of like a test ground for our own emotions. You know, if you are someone who is very anxious and very stressed all the time, and you say, you know, I want to really try and push myself to see how I respond in these very high arousal sorts of situations. So you can go into that environment, say it's a haunted house or even watching a scary movie, and test yourself and say, okay, I want a challenge. I want to do this and see if I can expand my emotional range. And in doing so, become more comfortable when you are in a high-stress situation, not of your choosing. So it's kind of like, I think of it like training wheels for dealing with real stress and fear.
So the idea is, if you're a high-anxiety type of personality, by pushing yourself to have new fear experiences, you've increased your tolerance?
Yeah. My colleague, Greg Siegel, we're working on an article right now where we talk about this idea of stress recalibration, that when you have pushed yourself to such an extreme in a safe way, you have kind of reset your stress tolerance level. So it's acting as a form of distress tolerance, and you are like, yeah, well, I just went through a terrifying haunted house and I did okay. Maybe I can go into work tomorrow and ask for that raise. And what's interesting is, just, you know, anecdotally, here at the haunted house, when I see people waiting in line and then coming out, when they come out, they are, you know, high-fiving and are sort of showing this higher level of self-confidence and self-esteem, like they can just go out and take on the world. And that's definitely something I experienced too after all of the different adventures and activities. I would finish and just feel like, okay, I'm ready to just go and do absolutely anything I want.
You have seen some pretty wild reactions in the haunted house. Can you talk about some of those reactions to fear?
Sure. Yeah, people's reactions in fear, you know, there are a lot of similarities and these sort of universal responses that our body are going through. But then in different cultures and different, you know, places, you do see some interesting kind of reactions. When I was in Japan going through the haunted hospital, the way that groups go through the haunted house was very different than what I see here in the United States. In Japan, everyone circles very close together, and when a startle scare would happen, instead of sort of expanding outwards, which I see a lot here in the States. You know, you get scared and people throw their arms up and jump back or out. There came closer together and huddled more closely and sort of crouched down lower to the ground. So, yeah, there were some interesting differences. And then, of course, there are the people who get so scared that they may pee their pants or accidentally, you know, punch someone. That's just sort of that impulsive reaction to especially something that's coming towards their face. You know, if it's a actor that pops right out in your face, the reaction to push away with your hand is pretty hard to resist. So the one reaction I don't see very frequently is the freezing reaction where somebody just stops. Mm-hmm. I've seen it a few times, and it's always to me a signal that this person really has been pushed too far, where they can't keep going, and that's when somebody goes in and says, okay, it's okay, let's walk out and calm down, it's okay.
I'm talking today with Margie Kerr. She's a sociologist who studies fear, and she's written this book called Scream. It explains the science of fear and how it affects our minds and bodies. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what is actually happening to us during that fearful roller coaster ride. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith Middleton. We'll be right back. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in for Faith. We've been talking today with Margie Kerr. She's a sociologist who studies fear, and she's written this book called Scream. It explains the science of fear and how it affects our minds and bodies. I described the anticipation of a roller coaster ride in the opening, but what's really happening in our minds and bodies in that situation?
Yeah, so research has shown that a lot of dopamine is released in anticipation of something happening, something pleasurable, something desirable. So, you know, when we're riding that coaster and we're strapped into the car and we hear the click, 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 there are all of these cues that are telling us something amazing is about to happen. And so in our brain, it's preparing, and so it's releasing these neurotransmitters, and it's releasing different hormones and pushing our body into this amazing chemical cascade that energizes us. And in my mind, it always makes me feel like I've sort of gone primal, that my thinking has shut down. I'm not worried about, you know, what I'm doing tomorrow. I'm not worried about deadlines. In that moment, I'm just completely in my body, experiencing this anticipation, this excitement of what's to come. And then when the coaster finally does sort of just turn the apex and start flying down the track, it's nothing but exhilaration, 'cause you're just completely in your body. And I think that for a lot of people today who spend most of their time in their head, you know, thinking on the computer, on their phone, opportunities to be fully in your body are highly sought after and can feel really good.
You traveled the world riding roller coasters.
Yeah.
Talk about your experience.
Yeah, so I went to Fuji Q Highland in Japan, and that was amazing. They have, I think, about 14 different thrill rides that are either current or former Guinness World Record holders. And they were amazing. They have a 4D coaster, which is a coaster that not only, you know, loops around and goes upside down, but the cars themselves actually rotate 360 degrees. So it just, you know, your body doesn't know what is happening. All of our systems of prediction are thrown out of whack. And so I just imagine that my brain is saying, I don't know which way is up, I don't know which way is down, and it's really a great sensation that not everybody loves, though. So, yeah, Japan, the roller coasters were great. I felt really lucky to see so many different types of thrill rides, and, you know, they have one coaster that is the fastest at takeoff, so the acceleration, I forget the exact statistics on it, but, you know, you basically are leaving your entire body behind, and, you know, you feel like your stomach has been left at the station as you sort of are propelled forward. I also went to Cedar Point in Ohio. They're the roller coaster capital of the world, and rode, I forget how many roller coasters I rode there, but they were all wonderful too. And I do have my favorites now. I know what types of sensations I really like and which ones, you know, I could do without.
What was the most challenging for you?
The most challenging was actually just recently, and it wasn't in the book. It happened after I finished. It was just this summer, the Black Widow at Kennywood here in Pittsburgh. I couldn't believe it. I didn't expect it to throw me the way that it did, but it's a thrill ride that takes you pretty much all the way upside down, sort of like a pirate ship, but a next-level pirate ship where you're going completely 180, and you have a hang time at the top of at least 2 or 3 seconds, and I mean, you're upside down staring at the ground, and I couldn't help but think, oh my gosh, you know, if I am dropped right now, you know, you're dead. But it was just completely exhilarating. So that one, each time it would go up, I would think, oh God, I don't think I want it to go back up again. But
wow.
It was fun.
Okay, you guys have all the best stuff, the best rides, the best haunted houses. We're talking with Margie Kerr about her new book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. It's about how fear works in our minds and bodies. Fear is not quite as simple an emotion as we might imagine. For instance, thrill rides, as we've been talking about, are a unique type of scary. They involve more of the physical rather than the intellectual. And I want to talk about another experience that you had where you describe being in a full fight or flight mode at the CN Tower in Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
It was hair-raising to read about. Can you take us back to that experience?
Sure. When I went to Toronto to experience the Edge Walk, I was not afraid at all. I really thought that it would be one of the least challenging experiences because I have not been afraid of heights. I thought, well, you know, you just go up and you stand on the side of this building. You're strapped to the, you know, metal grate. There's no chance of falling. So in my head, I thought, well, this is going to be simple. This is just going to be a walk in the park, just 117 stories high. But when I got up there, I was shocked. I was shocked at what my body did. And this is another reason why I love, you know, scary, thrilling, or really just new experiences, is because you think you know what you're going to do. You think you know what your body's going to do, and it just doesn't do that at all. As soon as I walked out on the ledge, everything in me just went crazy. I couldn't hear. I felt like I couldn't hear. I felt like I couldn't see anything. I felt like my legs were, you know, shaking, but also sort of lead at the same time. And I just lost all focus. And I think experienced definitely some vertigo. So just, you know, dizziness and disorientation. And now I understand why that happens, you know, when we're so high or we are in an area where we can't set our eyes on something, it's difficult to determine balance. And so we lose our sense of where we are in space.
But your thought process completely stopped.
Yes. Oh, yeah. My thinking brain just completely shut down. And that is something that happens a lot when there's an intense threat. Our thinking brain, our executive functioning in our prefrontal cortex just sort of shuts down because all of the messages from our limbic system, primarily our amygdala and sort of the older part of our brain, those messages are taking priority and saying, okay, you know, thoughts, rational thinking, logic, all of that is not important. Right now we need to make sure that the body is getting the adrenaline it needs, that it's getting all of the hormones it needs to start, you know, burning as much sugar and being a powerful machine. So our thinking brain just stops. And it's that process. It's actually the sort of pushing thinking brain to the back burner that is usually responsible for why people pee their pants, because the messages that we tell ourselves to hold it aren't getting through because all of these other messages are overwhelming our body. And so I actually did think that I had peed my pants because I felt so warm. You know, I felt all of my extremities sort of just starting to burn, and I thought, oh my gosh, did I pee my pants? Because, you know, it was all of this heat, and that was the threat response, and all of the chemicals working their way through my body, and my body sort of starting to kick up the metabolism. But I couldn't tell if I actually had or not, and I just was in a state of shock. And I didn't, thank God.
But you thinking that is exactly what got you out of that fear response.
Yeah. It was when I started to think, oh my gosh, should I pee my pants, that I immediately sort of switched gears and became embarrassed. And I started thinking, what are all of the people around me going to think? And, you know, what is the guide going to think? And so because that concern sort of started to take center stage in my mind, I was able to sort of come back into the thinking mode. So it's sort of a unintended consequence of me being especially terrified of social judgment that really brought my thinking brain back, and I was able to sort of gather myself and continue walking out onto the ledge. But for a moment there, I thought that I was just, you know, going to drop and be done.
And this had never happened to you before?
No. I mean, I've been through so many different kinds of thrilling things, and this was very different. And I think it is because, you know, heights, everyone is going to have a physiological response when they are in high elevations, just because our body was not made to be, you know, usually that far above ground. And I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't think that I would be that scared. And there really is something about looking down. And even though I rationally knew that I was safe, that lizard brain just said, you know what, you can't fly.
Right.
If you fall, you're going to die. You should be terrified.
And you so didn't scream.
No, I didn't scream. In fact, I was just silent. I couldn't say anything. And the guide, Margot, she told me, she's like, just look at the tower. Just look at the tower to try and give me something to focus on.
So is there such a level as being beyond screaming, so scared?
I don't know if any research has looked at it. I think that the shock sort of state is not going to elicit a scream as much as the startled but not completely terrified. But yeah, I'm not sure how, which will predict whether or not you are sort of going to scream or go silent.
This is Margie Kerr. She's a sociologist who studies fear, and she's written this book called Scream. It explains the science of fear and how it affects our minds and bodies. Can you talk about the scream itself? Why do we have this sometimes uncontrollable ability to scream?
Sure. The scream is just one of our evolutionarily adapted tools in our toolbox, and we scream for a lot of reasons. For one thing, when we scream, we are also showing our teeth and usually widening our eyes, flaring our nostrils, so our face is contorting into a more terrifying image, which can, you know, scare away other predators or whatever is attacking us. It makes us into a scarier person. Just if you think about, like, reptiles who change colors or puff themselves up. I had an iguana for 6 years, and whenever he was scared, you know, he would just puff all the way up. And so our scream, when we do that, our face is becoming more scary. It also, researchers think, is opening our airways, that we're, you know, we're sort of expanding ourselves so that we can take in more air afterwards. And then, of course, notifying others who may be around that there is a threat afoot and that we should avoid or to come and assist. So it's a combination of all of those things. And then, of course, if the scream is loud enough, and it can, you know, effectively scare away whatever is threatening us. So it's almost another weapon we have against a potential threat.
You visited an abandoned prison.
Yeah.
This one was the most disturbing to me. Can you talk about what you were trying to study by going there?
Sure. So I spent the night at an abandoned prison, and I wanted to really dig into psychological fear, you know, the monsters that are inside of our brains. I thought, you know, what better place than an institution that has a long history of, you know, trauma, of very frightening things, whether or not, you know, you are put in there as a criminal or if you're working there as a staff member. These institutions, historical institutions, often were the sites of abuse and a lot of scary stuff, and they still are. And so I wanted to tap into that and try and explore what it is about isolation in particular that can be so scary and that takes us to such dangerous places in our mind. So I went to Eastern State Penitentiary, where solitary confinement was introduced as a form of imprisonment. So prior to that, you know, most prisons were places to hold people or to, you know, the punishment was going to prison. But at Eastern State, the goal was rehabilitation, and they thought that this could happen through solitary confinement. And, of course, they saw very quickly that the exact opposite happens, that when we are denied of physical contact, of social interaction, we do go crazy. We go into the very dark places in our minds because there's nowhere left to go because you're isolated. So I spent the night in one of the punishment cells underground, and it was terrifying. And it mostly is because when you don't have anywhere to go and you have nothing in your environment to sort of hold your attention, you do go into the recesses of your mind and you start thinking about, you know, things that you've done wrong, or you think about things other people have done wrong. And of course, in the context of being in a prison, that's where my mind went. But it is a kind of torture that is just as scary, just as bad as, you know, any kind of physical threat. So, and what was so interesting in learning about how the body responds to isolation is, again, seeing the importance of choice and control. You know, people who go to sensory deprivation tanks or sweat lodges are, you know, in some cases in a very similar situation. They're isolated, but it's their choice. They are doing this for a very different purpose. And I saw that in a lot of things, in a lot of scary situations. It's more about the context rather than the actual, you know, thing that is happening. So that was a scary experience just for the solitude, but then also being in a place that has such a long history, you know, it carries so much weight. You know, when you're in historic institutions, you can't help but think about all of the people who have been there throughout time and what they have gone through. And our ability to empathize, you know, takes us to that very emotional place really quickly, so that it becomes an intense emotional experience.
And was that an experience that you were expecting? Because I know you were there to study what would happen scientifically and the physical explanation of what was going on. But were you surprised at the emotions it brought out?
I was. I really was. And I don't know that I was completely prepared for it, because when I came out of the hole, I really felt in a very vulnerable place emotionally. And I was very lucky to have my good friend there who brought me sort of back to reality, back out of my brain. And it was hard, but it really was a very powerful moment for me. It did end up, you know, I while I was in the hole, I reflected on a lot of my own history and thought about, you know, my relationship with my family. And it did, you know, eventually lead to me reaching out to family members I hadn't spoken to in years. And I don't think that would have happened if I hadn't created a space to push myself to confront these things. But again, in an environment where I knew I wouldn't be down in the hole forever. Mm. So it was hard, but very, very worthwhile.
And you went back to Eastern State Penitentiary, which I should say is in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Why did you go back?
I went back to do a paranormal investigation, so completely different contexts the second time, which was really weird, because now I had these very strong memories and emotional connections to this space as a sort of transformative moment, and now I was back, you know, hunting for ghosts. And I'm a, you know, I'm beyond skeptic, but, you know, the ghost hunt, the paranormal activity, ended up being an equally intense experience, but far more, you know, enjoyable, and I would say more in line with the kind of thrill-seeking, sensation-seeking, because the ghost hunting experience is, it's a lot like watching a scary movie. You know, you build the anticipation, just waiting for something to happen, and it's fun. It was a lot of fun.
So what happened in that investigation that you say was thrilling and equally as an intense experience, but yet you don't believe in ghosts?
Yeah, I watched about, I think there were around 10 professional sort of ghost hunters with all different types of equipment, and I sort of was their shadow in the beginning, just following them around, watching them take photos and use their devices to measure, you know, electromagnetic waves and just sort of observing. But I very quickly found myself not necessarily believing, but I suspended my disbelief. I sort of leaned in to mm-hmm. the experience, and I got so caught up in really wanting to see a ghost. There was a psychic in the group, and she was having conversations with ghosts that she was seeing, and I just, you know, for, again, a moment, was not thinking, you know, like a sociologist, and just, you know, being present in the moment and thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, this person is talking to someone, or is she talking to someone, and just let myself go in with the anticipation and the excitement. And what's interesting is, you know, when I think about that and I think about how much fun I had, and really how, just remembering it now, I feel giddy. From the outside, we really didn't do very much but walk around. But to me, you know, it was really exhilarating and fun.
You've said you're a skeptic. Did you believe that the psychic was actually communicating with spirits?
You know, in the moment, I believed that she believed, and I wanted to believe, you know, and I think that I just was not questioning at all, and just sort of feeling the intensity of the moment. And really, I wanted to believe so badly, and that, I think, was the fun part of it. It was almost like, you know, when I was a kid and we would play all of these imaginative games of, you know, monsters and dragons and castles, and it was just fun. It was just really fun to think and allow myself for a moment to think, okay, maybe there is a, you know, there is somebody at the end of that hallway, and it was fun.
Are you searching for something?
Am I? I don't know. I don't know if I think I'm always searching for more information. I have a desire to know as much as possible about everything. So as soon as I see something that I don't understand, I just desperately want to know. And I think that that's very human. You know, we're curious creatures. We want to explore our environment and we want to understand. And for me, I think that that desire is so strong that it does take center stage in my mind.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Margie Kerr about her new book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. It's about how fear works in our minds and bodies. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in today for Faith Middleton. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Laurie Mack, in for Faith. We've been talking today with Margie Kerr. She's a sociologist who studies fear, and she's written this book called Scream. It explains the science of fear and how it affects our minds and bodies. Margie, you've traveled all over the world looking for the paranormal experience and haunted houses. One of the places you visited was the forest in Mount Fuji that's known to be a place where people go to commit suicide. Can you tell the story of how this forest ended up being such a macabre destination, and maybe first describe what it looks like?
Sure. I always pronounce it incorrectly, and I apologize. The Ogigahara Forest at the base of Mount Fuji. It is known as one of the most, or the most spiritual place in Japan, and it's very easy to see why it's known for that, because the forest is so eerily beautiful. Being at the base of Mount Fuji, the ground is volcanic. It's this dark volcanic earth, and the contrast between the earth and then the vibrant green trees and ferns and moss, it's really just covered with moss and ferns. It's just stunning. And then when I was there, there's still snow on the ground, and so it was this vibrant green, this bright white, and then this dark volcanic ground. And so to look at it, you just are visually just so captivated. And it's also very quiet because the altitude and the location, there aren't many animals. And so it is very quiet, and any quiet place in today's world always feels a little bit weird. But when you're in a woods, you usually expect to hear birds or just different types of sounds, and that was not there. So I think that really gives it a heavy presence. And since it is volcanic, the trees have many, many exposed roots because they're growing over all these rocks, and it just gives it this otherworldly look. I think I originally in the book wanted to talk about how much I thought it reminded me of the Lord of the Rings, one of the in the Shire, and because it was just so beautiful, it was so stunning. But because it you know is this more kind of spiritual place, it became known for lots of different folklore, or rather ghost lore, that it was, you know, some people say one of the locations for the seven gates of hell, that it's where, you know, spirits sort of dwell. Not always negative ghost stories or spiritual stories, but the negative ones that I was seeing were about how, you know, when people have a bad death, this is where their soul remains and their ghost is there and will hurt you, basically. There's a lot of ghost lore in Japan. And it's also the number one suicide destination in Japan, because the belief about your ghost sort of continuing to haunt if you have a bad death, people who commit suicide would go to the forest to ensure that their family or their friends, you know, wouldn't be haunted by their ghost. So the location now has a very dark cloud around it because it is known for being a suicide destination.
How did it end up that way?
Well, back in the 60s, there was a story written about two lovers who went into the woods to commit suicide. And so that sort of made it popular as a destination. And then there was another book, a manual actually, on how to kill yourself, that named the forest as the number one place to commit suicide. So those two books, combined with the history of it being a very spiritual place, made it kind of the choice of destinations. And it's interesting, you know, globally, you do see that certain destinations become sort of known for being a destination for suicide, like the Golden Gate Bridge, and they take on new meaning as a suicide destination.
Mm. I mentioned earlier how you visited the murder and kidnapping capital of the world. What was the lesson there, and where are we now?
Yeah, I went to Bogota in Colombia. What I learned there was, I think, really powerful for me as a sociologist. I definitely saw a lot of theories, a lot of, you know, research that I had been doing all through grad school firsthand, you know, the impact of inequality, of poverty, of violence in surrounding areas. And so I was really, you know, front and center to see all of the things that I had read about as a graduate student and a sociologist. And the crime, street crime in Bogota is very high. It's lower than it used to be, but compared to the U.S., it is very high. I talked to anthropologists and historians, psychologists, economists, and they all, you know, had a similar sort of story that in Bogota and in many countries where there's a high level of actual violence, the approach to engaging with symbolic violence, or, you know, things like haunted houses or scary movies, it's a different relationship. And, you know, because the population is preparing for when a threatening event will happen, so it's not will you have your phone stolen, it's when you have your phone stolen, it's a different type of relationship to fear. In the U.S., we often will think in terms of avoidance. So I don't want to experience street violence, so I'm going to avoid all of these places. And we think about how to protect ourselves. We don't think about as much how we're going to survive, how we're going to make it through when something bad does happen. And I think that that's a very different mindset. And I think, you know, in Bogota, I have friends who are there, just have a very different approach to fear. They don't go to see horror movies or haunted houses or anything like that as much. But they don't walk around as afraid as a lot of my friends here, because they know, okay, well, yes, my phone may get stolen. I may, you know, end up being robbed at the ATM. But when that happens, I'll get through it and my life will go on. And, you know, that's, I think, a different approach than here. And I think that it's related to our engagement with, you know, symbolic violence. So, you know, we kind of need these opportunities to kind of test ourselves to see how we're going to respond. Whereas there, everybody kept saying, if I want to be scared, I'll just go into the street.
Right. So they're living it. So yeah. They don't need to expose themselves to the fake reality.
Right. Right.
So I know you've learned a lot about how we deal with fear on a scientific level. What do you think your research has done for you personally?
I am more confident than I have ever been in my life. And it's just amazing. And it's something that I was reflecting on just the other day. I actually wrote a blog post about it because I was thinking about where I was 2 years ago and just looking through old emails and conversations. And I realized that I am a completely different person, that I speak up more often. And today I voice, you know, my opinions. I voice my concerns. It is changing relationships. You know, some people are just getting to know this new confident Margie, but it is a sense of self and a sense of confidence that I've just never had before. And I really do think that it's because, you know, when you hang from the side of a building or you go someplace like the suicide forest, in each of these moments, I was reminded of my own mortality. And in doing that, in recognizing that or remembering that you're going to die, you're reminded that, wait, this is my life, and I should absolutely do and be everything that I want to do and want to be.
And it can all start with a roller coaster ride.
Yes. Yeah.
What's the message you want us to take away from your book?
To challenge oneself, even just in small ways, to eat something new, to try something new. As we get older, we try fewer things, you know, and I really want people to kind of think back to their childhood where everything was new and that joy of exploration was a daily occurrence. And it can still be today. It takes a little bit more work. But if you sort of approach life as a constant exploration, it can be so fulfilling and not scary at all, or scary in the good ways.
So are there any adventures that you've had that did not make it into the book?
Yeah, there are quite a few, actually, and one of them was in Connecticut.
Hmm.
I went to Connecticut with a friend, actually, and then while I was there, decided to explore some of the local haunted or, you know, scary attractions or locations, and I found the Penfield Lighthouse in Fairfield. And so I drove out there with my friend Amy. I had read that during low tide, you can actually walk out to the lighthouse because it's only about a mile, and the sand dune or the sandbar was, you know, wide enough to walk out. I wanted to go because the lighthouse has a really huge history of being haunted and, you know, being a place where many have lost their life because the ghost in the watchtower would cause trouble with the boats, and the lighthouse itself was haunted, and you could see images of former caretakers from the distance. And I thought, well, this would be really great to go and visit while I'm here. So we got there and we started walking out to the lighthouse, and it was really beautiful, and it was a kind of overcast day, and it was even a little bit rainy, but the image was perfect for trying to engage with paranormal haunting type vibes. I saw the lighthouse in the distance and I thought, okay, this is going to be so cool. I can totally walk out here. And I just became so focused on getting to the lighthouse that I didn't notice that the tide was coming in.
Oh boy.
And Amy started screaming, you know, Margie, the tide's coming in, you know, we're not going to be able to get out there. And I thought, no, I can do it. And I just took off running because I thought, well, you know, I was already about halfway there. So 5 minutes, I can just run the rest of the way.
And what was your plan, though? You were going to get there, go in, and come back out?
Well, exactly. I didn't think ahead at all. I was so caught up in the moment, and by nature, I'm a very impulsive person, that I just didn't stop to think, you know, even if I get there, there's no way that I'm getting back. So I just said, no, I can do it. And I started running, and Amy said, you can't do this. You've got to stop. So I finally did stop. I turned around and saw that behind me there were already sections of the sandbar that had started to be covered by water. So I ran back and
wise decision.
I did end up in about a couple inches of water. But, you know, I was so caught up in the moment. I was so engaged in that kind of suspension of disbelief and not thinking logically at all. All I could see was getting to this haunted lighthouse, and everything else just didn't matter.
So that's your next book, What Happens When You Become Hyper-Focused, and logic has eluded you?
Yes. There were so many times where my thinking brain, it was just nowhere to be found. And I completely see why, you know, the trope of the scared person who runs up the stairs instead of out the door. I mean, it's definitely a real thing. We're not thinking straight when we're afraid.
Well, it's an interesting topic. The book is called Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear by my guest, Margie Kerr. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. This is great.
I'm Laurie Mack, sitting in today for Faith Middleton. Thank you for listening.